case is a very good example of this, but even in smaller sort of disputes in workplaces and in terms of trying to get any sort of resistance going in the workplace, workers too often have to battle with their own union hierarchy before they can bring the struggle for better terms and conditions to the bosses. All these problems help create and maintain tensions and antagonisms within the existing labour movement, and it's those tensions and antagonisms that, for organised, that's where we believe the potential can come for a revolutionary labour movement. In recent years we've seen splits in unions, the Irish Locomotive Drivers Association, probably not recent years anymore, they're getting old, split from Ireland's largest reformist trade union, SIFTU, and you also had the creation of the Irish Workers' Union following Mick O'Reilly's temporary expulsion from the Amalgamated Transport and General Workers' Union. When many on the left continue to argue against splitting the union movement, many workers have reached the end of their tolerance with the reformist unions, and there are examples of them taking matters into their own hands. Members of left unions, not because they're scabs, but because trade unions have failed, have basically failed the members of those unions. Others have what's done a thing called union hopping. It basically means they leave one reformist trade union and join another. Officials involved in recruiting them will sometimes promise them basically the earth for joining a different union, but at the end of the day, trade unions are organised pretty much the same way, and the same issues will recur in the new union. Splits like the ALDA failed to break with the model of organisation of the existing unions. Believed it was just enough to basically ditch SIFTU and set up their own union. The ALDA actually, in my opinion, represented something of a retreat from industrial organising into craft unionism. The ALDA, when they set up, talked about a return to traditional trade union values, but it was Irish locomotive drivers, train drivers, basically looking out for their own sectional interests. You know, so they actually retreated from a more industrial form of organisation. So they ended up going back at joining the Amalgamated Transport and General Workers Union as their own branch. Quite strange, like, maybe not strange, like, when they set up as a branch of the Amalgamated Transport and General Workers Union, SIFTU demanded that the Transport and General Workers Union give them back their members. Members who had left SIFTU, what, several years previously. Basically, in relation to workplace organising and in relation to the existing trade unions, organised believe in fostering solidarity and militancy amongst the largest possible number of workers, whether they're unionised or not. We believe decisions should be made collectively, and this means that mass meetings or assemblies should be held, and decisions and mandates should be gained from those meetings, from the people involved, and not the officials in distant union offices. These meetings, for us, should include all those in the workplace, again, regardless of union membership, other than management and scabs, of course. Anyone that's elected from those sorts of meetings to negotiate with management has a mandate from the workforce that gives them clear guidance on what is and what is not acceptable. Its delegates should also be recallable. In effect, we should be electing delegates on the basis of a mandate and not dealing through representatives that are representing a union to a workplace or workforce. Organisers also believe in something called direct action. There's a lot of confusion between direct action and other forms of action that are possibly best described as symbolic actions. I think Glen Eagles, G8, you know, Make Poverty History March is symbolic action. direct action for some has also become a byword for violence, to the extent that a lot of people now talk specifically about non-violent direct action. I think there's a problem with that, in that it implies that any other sort of direct action is necessarily violent. Basically, direct action is about, rather than speaking with the bosses, or for that matter, politicians through official intermediaries, it's about realising that we can only rely on ourselves as workers to achieve the goals that we set for ourselves. Direct action at work means strikes, go slows, work rule, occupations and boycotts. As the industrial workers in the world put it, direct action is any form of guerrilla warfare that cripples the boss's ability to make a profit and makes him or her cave in the workers' demands. The best known form of direct action is the strike, in which workers simply walk off their jobs and refuse to produce profits for the boss until they get what they want. Now, the strike has historically been such a powerful weapon for working class people that it has become severely curtailed, both by trade union bureaucracies and by successive anti-working class labour legislation. And the crippling sort of ideology of social partnership that exists within the existing unions. We are opposed to partnership with the bosses. Workers and bosses do not have common interests. And workers can only win serious concessions when industrial action is used, or when the bosses fear a workforce that's well enough organised to threaten industrial action. Solidarity is another key word, and it's key to victory, to achieving any sort of gains in the workplace. Workers should support each other's disputes in spite of anti-union legislation. Basically, that means don't cross picket lines. We also believe that strike funds need to be controlled by the workers themselves. I mean, there have been cases of industrial action being taken in the north before, and the firefighters dispute, and basically people went out with buckets and collected money for strike funds. You know, the money didn't come from, you know, it wasn't all sitting there in a big pot ready to come out of people's union dues. We sort of think that if people are paying dues into a union, it should be to support industrial action. It should be to support workers who are struggling and facing hardship due to industrial action. That money shouldn't be going and paying for fucking cars or fat cat salaries for trade union bureaucrats. We also don't believe that backing the Labour Party or any other political party is in the interest of workers. The parliamentary system is about working class people giving up their power and control. It's not about them exercising it. Ultimately, the interests of working class people lies in the destruction of capitalist society. The whole of the wealth of society is produced by workers. However, a huge proportion of this is turned into profits that working class people don't see a penny of. When workers make wage demands, they're simply trying to win a bigger slice of what is already rightfully theirs. Our ultimate aim is a self-managed, stateless society based on the principle of each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. A society where we are no longer just used as a means to an end by bosses wanting to make money out of our labour. Right, so what are we hearing now? While organised don't see the reformist trade union movement as vehicles for revolutionary change, we encourage the creation of strong rank and file movement of workers in both unionised and non-unionised workplaces. We do not at this stage advocate the setting up of small breakaway unions that will, you know, be isolated and lack support. Even in non-union workplaces, which might seem like the perfect place to try and organise new unions from scratch, the reality is that these unions will be small and lack effective backing. However, where any youth workers want to form such unions, we will lend them our full support. Basically, we believe it's their decision. When supporting the growth of a strong rank and file, we differentiate ourselves from those who advocate this in order to attempt to take over, seize control of, or reform the existing trade unions. We think they're pretty much irreformable. longer term tactic of strong rank and file should be to dump the current unions and create new ones. Unions controlled by their membership that recognise the only way to win any long term gain from capitalists or from capitalism is the overthrow. So long term, yes, we believe that a new union movement, a new revolutionary labour movement should be created. It's not something we're advocating in the short term, because this isn't just going to appear out of nowhere. It has to be built. There has to be a lot of hard work, organising, and building solidarity and links across the class need to be in place before we believe that can happen. But basically, only a strong, economically organised, politically aware rank and file of workers will be aware of its power to achieve this. To this end, and to strengthen the hand of the working class in the here and now, we work towards establishing contacts in as many industries as possible, especially and practically in industries where organised members work, and to assist in the creation of networks where contacts can be built and solidarity strengthened across industries. As part of this strategy, there was a meeting earlier on today. Organisers recently set up an education workers branch who want to pursue a sort of network strategy within the education industry. Networks of workplace militants we are seeking to build should not simply be paper exercises or email lists. Such networks should be hotbeds of militancy, promoting resistance and direct action by building and strengthening links between the workplace and community-based struggles. As such, they should be made up of workers involved in their day-to-day struggles in their industry while promoting solidarity across traditional sectional boundaries of trade unionism. Again, direct action is essential to this. It's also an essential preparation for the free socialist society we're striving to create. Through engaging in direct action, even when we make mistakes, we have the opportunity to learn from experience that there is no need to leave things to experts, and often every need not to listen to them. Until we start to act for ourselves, we will continue to experience disempowerment, betrayal, broken promises, which combine to hold us in the grip of an all-pervading sense of powerlessness. In reality, we are far from powerless. We must begin to control our own struggles by building a culture of resistance that links with other workers in struggle, both locally and globally. We can start small, but we must and have seen workers make this start. Solidarity and mutual aid find real expression in direct action, and as our confidence grows, so will our ability to change the world.
Okay, well, sir, I'd like to thank an organiser for giving us this opportunity. Why do we give a special importance to workplace organising? Well, work is at the heart of the capitalist system. The system based on a small minority controlling the means of creating wealth and the rest of us working for them. It's not simply one more arena of struggle against injustice. It's where we can challenge the basis of capitalism itself by directly counterposing our needs and desires to those of the bosses. And it's where we have real strength, where we can go beyond protest. Nothing happens without human labour, without our work. As Joe Hill said, if the workers took a notion they could stop all speeding trains, every ship upon the ocean they could tie with mighty chains. That's pretty poetic. So how do we get organised? Well, we start with our unions. By far the largest organisation of working people. Not only are there 600,000 trade union members on this island, they belong to a movement whose very reason for existence is that bosses and workers have opposing interests. Now as anarchists, we get quite frustrated and angry at times that the great potential in the trade union movement is not realised. We get angry and frustrated when poor deals are agreed, when solidarity isn't forthcoming, and when an influential bureaucracy develops its own separate interests. It would be handy if all these problems were solely the fault of a layer of senior full-time officials, as if we were dealing with some sort of cancer that could be easily cut out. The reality is that our unions, like any other large organisation, reflect in a general way the ideas of our members. If most people go out at election time and vote DUP or Sinn Féin, SDLP or official unionists, then why on earth would we expect our unions not to be dominated by fairly cautious conservative thinking? But that's no reason to despair. We know this can change, and it can change fairly quickly. We know this because it's happened before, and many a time. The history of the trade union movement has more than its fair share of inspiring episodes. Much of what we take for granted today was won through mass trade union struggle. Paid summer holidays, paid maternity leave, the 8-hour day, just to name three things. So how do we rebuild a combative trade unionism and move from the defensive and start fighting for more of the good things of life? And today, I suppose, I've been fighting for above inflation pay rises for shorter hours. How do we build a movement that will also use its muscle to advance broader class interests, like refusing to process water bills, refusing to engage in disconnections? Some activists think the most realistic solution is to elect a left-wing leadership. Sometimes they also argue that full-time officials in the unions should get no more than the average wage of their members and should have to stand for regular re-election. There's nothing wrong with supporting candidates you agree with. The unions are our organisation, so of course we should take an interest in who's on the national executive and who's employed by us. The problem arises, however, when electing leaders becomes far more important than winning support for the sort of rule changes that would allow far more membership participation and far more democracy. This idea, usually known as the broad left strategy, concentrates on leadership. So maybe we should start off by asking if leaders are a good thing and if they are necessary. These two questions go together, since if leaders are necessary, then common sense tells us they must also be a good thing. And here at Major, we're talking about the sort of leadership that divides us into leaders and led, the sort of leadership that keeps us passive and dependent on somebody else. Almost 100 years ago, this very issue was discussed in the Miners' Union in South Wales, and one of the documents produced at the time had this to say, just one paragraph: "Let us then examine the leader and see if he is necessary. A leader implies at the outset some men who are being led, and the term is used to describe a man who, in a representative capacity, has acquired combined administrative and legislative power. As such, he sees no need for any high level of intelligence in the rank and file, except to applaud his actions. Indeed, such intelligence from his point of view, by breeding criticism and opposition, is an obstacle and causes confusion. His motto is, men, be loyal to your leaders." And I don't think things have changed a lot, certainly my own union in situ. Whenever there are internal disputes, at the end of the day, the final cry of the full-time apparatus usually is, stand by your leadership, i.e. put your criticism aside. Now the problem we see is not just that individuals can be corrupted. I think we're all corruptible, given the opportunity. It's just that most of us don't get the opportunity. But it's also that the power of initiative, the sense of collective responsibility that comes from making decisions, is taken away from the members and given to the leaders. Most of the members are reduced to inactivity and passivity. Attendance at meetings, participation in internal union life, and even basic identification with the union declines as power shifts away from the workplace and the branch. Of course, not all advocates of the broad left strategy see things this way. But I believe that the reality is they still see their main task as getting better leaders elected to positions of influence. The rank and file's job is to elect a new leadership who will then bring about change from above. Clearly that's not one as anarchist that we think is either desirable or realistic. The second option talked about is building a rank and file movement. This is the strategy for organising within the unions to win more democracy, more struggle against the bosses, and more involvement by the membership. Its attitude is best summed up by the slogan, "With the officials when possible, without them when necessary." Where there have been large rank and file movements, they have always been based on confident groups of workers who find that the union officialdom is an obstacle standing in their way. They're then forced to ignore the instructions of head office and disobey them if their struggle is to be successful. This could start with people being denied official sanction for a strike, or encountering obstruction from head office when you need to spread your strike, are just refusing to get sucked into the never-ending rounds of mediation and arbitration. The point is that large rank and file groupings are created when workers are fighting the bosses, are confident, and then find union officials are trying to limit or even sabotage the struggle. The need for independent organisation within the unions is then posed. Struggle creates genuine rank and file movements. It's not the other way around. At a time like now, when most workers are on the defensive and lacking in confidence, attempts to create such groups will attract only small numbers of activists. This isn't to pour cold water on such attempts when they arise out of a genuine desire to take on the bosses and the bureaucracy. It's just to maybe caution against setting unrealistic goals at this stage. A third option is building what we might call a solidarity network. We have to face the fact that at the moment, a good many trade union activists feel quite demoralised. They're doubtful about the possibility of fighting back against the employers, or even fighting back against union leaders like ICTU General Secretary David Begg, who just last month tried to offer their southern employers a below-inflation pay deal. But it's not all doom and gloom, thankfully. There are workers who want to fight back. You know some of them, and if you're here today, I guess you include yourself among them. We need to break down the isolation that makes us weak. We need to combat the social partnership ideas, whether the formal ones like we've had for the last 20 years in the South, or the informal ones that we see increasingly up here and in Britain. Interestingly, at the Dublin Mayday rally this year, one of the guest speakers was Patricia McKeown from here, who spent most of her speech going on about how wouldn't it be great in the six counties if we could have a social partnership agreement like we've had in the South for the last 20 years. A solidarity network to concrete things like produce magazines with factual information on disputes, wage deals, behaviour of union leaders. It could also be a forum for debating different ways of changing and improving our unions. Such a network would certainly be militant on the bread and butter issues, but it must also be political. This certainly doesn't mean that it should be dominated by any particular party or organisation. It does mean taking up questions like water charges, like racism, like war, as well as pay, promotions and union democracy. And I just want to win as many people as possible to our ideas. We are for freedom, for workers' control, for class struggle to overthrow capitalism and replace it with libertarian socialism. However, we don't make cooperation with other militant workers conditional on them agreeing with all our politics. A solidarity network, such as being proposed, would allow us to pool our efforts while at the same time discussing the different strategies for putting union power where it should be, back in the workplace. It's a moderate proposal, quite a modest one, but one that we believe could provide a springboard for bigger initiatives later on. And now it's probably as good a time as any to start making preparations.
Right, so, questions from the board?
Just make a couple of quick brief points. For workers, what's going on?
Has everyone here in the room heard about the Boston Network Workers? What's been happening? Or anything about the history of it? Or?
I have.
Would it be useful there?
Yeah,
just 6 years ago, a number of business security workers in Belfast International Airport were in Union TNG and which is now Unite. They balloted for strike action, which got 100% for a 50p an hour increase on wages that were at the time very, very low. It was £6.50 they were asking for a few pence extra an hour pay rise. And the company they're working for, an international airport, ICTS, which is a security company linked to the Israeli Defence Force, which is basically run by a retirement scheme for officers from the IDF to go into it, and they set it up and are fed in the anti-union. Their response, what happened was the strike was called, was officially accepted, the ballot went even through all the Thatcherite anti-trade union laws, it was accepted. The morning of the strike, it came out that the company had said the strike had been repudiated by the union itself, the central bureaucracy of it. And what actually occurred was that a branch officer, Jordan Cusker, had gone to the company, handed over all the names of union members in the workplace, and unofficially, completely illegally, repudiated the strike action. The other time, the TNG was under a very, very right-wing leadership under Bill Morris and Brendan Hodgers, who had been the regional sort of secretary for Ireland. All the workers in the airport were sacked. put out, and it was, they went through a whole different spirit and the reasons how they sat there, went through it. That was every single trade union member that was sacked and put out. The union refused to back up the campaign of the workers because they were complicit in getting them sacked. In the course of their struggle, first of all against the airport, using protests, further action that they could, whatever they could take, the leadership of the TNG union changed. There was a Bill Morris put out, and supposedly left-winger in the form of Tony Woodley came into leadership, and in Ireland it's like Jimmy Kelly came in. They initially agreed at the start that they would take up the case of the airport workers, that they would fight it for them and try and do it. Tony Woodley at the time did actually negotiate within trying to sort out this group, the ICTS and SAC. The airport workers negotiated a terrible deal, but in fact the workers was completely rejected, and the union washed their hands of them. So the airport workers, particularly the three shop shirts, Chris Bauer, Madame Gupta and George McNeil, they took their action through the courts by themselves on their own. They put their houses up on mortgages and were under threat of losing their homes, took it up that way. And we all, like everyone here, is quite veritable faith in the capitalist court system, and anyway, but still at the end, were able to win their case. That's how convincing it was that even the capitalist courts were not able to throw it out at this point, but they won it. They won an appeal as well of ICTS and went back to the union and said that, well, back us up there. We won a very important, three shop shirts won a very important trade union law, which sort of rolled back a little bit of the anti-Thatcher legislation in place that said that it is discrimination, which means that it's an unlimited amount of compensation if you are discriminated against on the basis of trade union or socialist beliefs. So trade union is linked to socialism, and that if you are seen to be a trade union member, it's political discrimination, you have unlimited compensation, whereas before, which is unfair dismissal, there was a smaller cap on compensation, so at least the employers a little less likely to try and attack trade union activists, although they're still going to go ahead of it. This is a very long running dispute, it says 6 years, and recently what's happened, maybe some people have read in the newspapers, that Gordon McNeil, this year the other two airport workers, shops on a hunger strike outside Transport House on a number of occasions to try and get the union to admit fault, to go over the lessons of the dispute, that go back to the membership of honesty and show what actually happened, and can try and stop it happening again in the future. Pay the legal fees that are outstanding, that have the shop shirts houses under threat and a huge amount of debt hanging over their head, and to basically challenge the leadership of Unite for bringing it up now, which is what TNG is now part of Unite. What actually happened in the case, a full open inquiry for the trade union movement could be moved into. But what happened instead was an injunction was placed on Gordon McNeil and the protests outside his own union building, which resulted in last week that Gordon was arrested for sitting in a deck chair outside Transport House where the court, well, not arrested, served an injunction and told to go to court this Wednesday passed. But actually happened, we organised protests outside the new office of Unite, which is up on Antrim Road, they moved up there, and we organised protests outside the court. The union were so, just beyond precedent in the history of the union movement, but it would be unprecedented in the recent period, or even up until the end of the Second World War, of trade unions being convicted in the capitalist courts by their own trade union and imprisoned because of them trying to fight back against the corruption of the union. This would be completely unprecedented. But the court was completely forced to drop the injunction, basically, there's no charge against Gordon, there was no costs awarded against him on the side of the trade union movement. None of the trade union leaders showed up at the court case. They'd be too ashamed, they didn't go in and have a worker convicted for standing up against it. And the injunction was basically proven completely incorrect, because you proved they're going down again on the day after the court case and protesting the same way again, and there's no way you could be brought forward in front of the courts. But what's happened instead is that a member of the Socialist Party, and we've been helping out Gordon, who's also a member in the case, is that instead of openly admitting what's happened, the fans ordered out, United gone in the offensive, called Gordon McNeil anti-union, have put up posters along the street here actually, and up until the Antrim Road, saying that the Socialist Party is an anti-union force, and that the United are trying to defend workers' rights, which is completely unbelievable that they would come out of this. But we produced a pamphlet of anyone's interest, it's £2 at the end, which deals with the precedent that the United put out, which have been very slanderous, have come out and said that we have been trying to completely undermine Unite and trying to attack the trade union movement, that we were called fascists on the Monday before the court case because we were attacking the trade union bureaucracy, and so we're the only far right people attack trade union bureaucracy and have the audacity to do it. But we've proven that they've lied on a number of occasions. We've gone through letters that the right wing produced at the time of the dispute that shows that they've lied. We've got all the evidence against what they've said, but they're still trying to get away with it. We've organised solidarity camps. I know comrades in WSM and organised have come along to in demonstrations outside Transport House during Gordon's hunger strike. demonstrated in Dublin, I said transfer price, and then in London, I said transfer price, trying to put pressure on them. But the case as it stands now, it's a very, very difficult one, and it really does show up the state of the trade union movement as well at the moment, that some of the people have gone into. So the trade unions are not as militant as you would have seen, maybe stronger leaders in the 70s or 80s, they're quite a socially conservative force of leadership anyway. And it's reality being able to get away with this because there's just no participation at a rank and file level in the trade union movement, which is unfortunate, but as people have already gone into, I completely agree with the concept of change in time, struggles begin to come up. A lot of people will look at the first point of call in the workplace to be the trade union, and the first thing they'll find is that their leadership are going to be found wanting, and they'll see the old leadership capacity pushed out. Not in the same way that you saw the right wing of Bill Morris and TNG being replaced with a soft left wing that immediately became just as bad as the right wing, is that a more accountable force will come into it. And I just want to leave with that on the updates of the airport workers. I'd like to come in maybe later on in the discussion about the points about the trade unions that have been raised, but just for comments information.
So anybody have anything to ask any of the three comrades or any points to raise? General, on the floor.
Can I raise one? For 38 standard points. How many times has anybody just called heard of the bourgeoisie evil problem? 40,000 is on the thing. And there's something happens in it. The bosses can't control it. The other case is anarchy and overnight.
Those times.
How many times has somebody lifted the phone and complained about that? Because it's totally untrue. Managers are not disruptive people. They create good order and discipline within society, but they don't believe in taking for granted Kent judges, that's about K-I-N-T, Kent judges who make summary executions or execute. And I don't mean that, but I mean passing jail sentences on people whose only crime was to organise the working class. How many people have protested about that?
Not too many reasons.
None. I tell you what, you know, me, I get on the top back and compare this up on the air. I'll take it out for some of you.
Maybe you'll get on another thing. Just to be devil's advocate, I'm actually a member of the United, and I have read some of the statements by the leadership, and they claim that that they're not like the original. They admit that Bill Morris was a very bad leadership, and that the guy who actually originally touted on the workers to the bosses, he's been pushed out of the union, as I understand, and they try to distance themselves from that, and they say no, they're elite. And they also say that they actually, even though some of these people were not in good standing with the union, no longer paying their dues, they say they actually paid all the dues of all these legal fees, and they also say that the agreement they tried to reach with the three airport workers was that they would pay their legal fees if they didn't they put it bad mouth the union, which means bad mouth the leadership after they do this deal. That's their view. Would anybody like to just respond to that? I could myself, but
it wasn't even that we weren't like bad mouth, but the two of the structures actually did take it because they were 71 and one in a bad mouth to sort of leave the sort of the demands that were put on taking compensation, they didn't pay legal fees but compensation, was that not even bad mouth leadership, that we'd never talk of this dispute ever again in public arena. They can't get any meetings, they can't be lessons from it, but no one can go back to them. And Gordon didn't take the money, refused to take the gagging clause, and went unrestricted gain, and so maybe hurt his health like as well.
Also, there are members of Organised, there are members of Unite, and there are members of the Socialist Party, I'm pretty damn sure, are members of Unite. Now, when the leadership of the union is that bad, where do you draw the line? Like, is at any point do you say, look, this union is so bad, let's leave this union and join just another reformist union? Or what do you think of that?
I would actually say in defence of the Socialist Party as an anarchist,
they were the real ones that kickstarted this thing against the water charges. You know, they broke up and you know, I mean, certainly, you know, really, I don't know, I was kickstarting John Corey or whatever, you know, but I just didn't do too much. I was a real, you know. That was a real achievement, you know. That was a working class achievement, because that was from the grassroots. And whether or not there were, you know, there you go. That's probably a failure on our
part. It's not a failure on our part. It's gone.
You were saying whether there's a line you can draw. Well, I've worked in a workplace where there's a fairly militant working control union. With, well, when I say working control, I mean they used to have assemblies on a regular basis with all workers making decisions and setting the direction of the union. And in the same workplace, there was a fascist union, so which was competing. So that was at a different time. That was when fascists could actually organise in South Africa, could organise a racist union. In that case, you can draw the line. You know, you can draw the line and say, okay, well, that organisation is actually counter-revolutionary. But in the case of fights and the leadership, it's basically a case of organising the rank and file workers against that bureaucracy. And it comes as no surprise that the bureaucracy is, you know, that it has its own interests, which is opposed to the workers in the union.
There's two points one I should have made that were the workers, municipal workers in the municipal union. And I can only talk for our guy. There's a truck that goes around sweeping the streets. At one time they had a bloke sitting beside the driver who got up with the brush and brushed the top off the pavement. No longer in existence. The driver does that. The other one is the employment of Belfast Higher Bands. Put up and collect, bring, distribute the mail to the boxes where the postmen collect their mail from. That's done away with. The barons belong to the GPO and the drivers belong to the GPO. Done away with them. Not one word, I haven't heard of one word.
As I said, the comrades here said that we've moved on to defensive, but a lot of the cases were not even being defensive.
No.
Lots of corporate, especially the public services are being privatised, and the big private companies are doing away with a lot of jobs. So it's,
well, you're guarding here. What's worse than the system? The system is not going to get back and say, you know, we'll have to deal with things as they are. They're not going to get back. And by the way, we're privatising our public services. Do you understand? It's up to us.
That's what I'm saying.
You know.
Sean.
I think what people's head missing, you can talk there, not even about trade union, but where the workplace business, because it does happen every day of our lives in our workplace. For example, people think back an informal level, not so much physical, such as sabotage, such as theft, well, it's not the other workplace, such as maybe ghost coming in sick, etc. So it does, we have to touch on more of the way the workplace resistance does happen every day in a less visible way.
Okay, what do you mean by that? I used to work in printing McDonald's sleeves and I'm supposed to steal them. What do you mean by that? I'm curious.
Maybe stealing
that's
ours, but that won't be worked for and won't be produced basically.
There is a case for workplace sabotage. That's probably taking it further when you go on RB strike action. But what the working class people are being attacked with today is even the right to withdraw your labour, which is a fucking human right. That is something different. The spanner in the works come when you, you know, when you actively put something in there, you know, when you talk, you know.
So there is
laws. I mean, so called the Socialist Labour Party are, you know, the clause, whatever it is, secondary picket action, solidarity with your brothers,
necessarily. We're talking about a position where we want to outlaw every
doctor
brotherhood.
Okay.
And New Labour
have cemented it.
They've cemented it because they haven't repealed it. But we're not looking at laws to repeal it. You know, solidarity is strength, scabs are scum. You know, if you can't support your working person, what do you left with? Society goes in now. And they're wondering why all these deadlines, you know. People getting pregnant with this, no social cohesion, and yet they're saying this about the family, about, you know. Do I say something?
I just want to raise a couple other points as well. I guess there's general agreement, like an airport, workers, there's a company doing here to come down and help out in the protest. There's no, I don't think this ever happened unless it's been raised. There's historical differences over tactics in the long campaign of the airport workers, but the initial one, I think, comes in general agreement. But I'd like to raise some just general political points, maybe for the discussion that the comments can come back in on, is this on trade unions as a whole, like obviously socialism and Marxism, there could be differences between us and anarchism, but how that's viewed, and I'm not fully even sure if full anarchists are syndicalists on a point on, but as far as I can see, the trade unions are not, they're not vehicles of a revolutionary change society. They're important vehicles to move into the mass majority of the working class, whether or not they're in trade unions or not. We'll usually follow the lead of it in strike times and struggle with the trade union movement. And just on historical arguments that come up before, where the Trotskyist movement have discussed about, particularly anarchist syndicalists, it's a bit historical, but the French CGTU was like a left wing split from the CGT and the French general TUC or whatever in the 1920s. There was a certain high ranking individual called Matt, who was an anarchist syndicalist, who Trotsky put a lot of time into discussing with in the 1920s, that he saw sort of left reformist leaders of the trade union movement, who he sort of compared to the French Socialist Party at the time, that had taken a national chauvinist point during the First World War. He looked to Monat, because Monat wasn't a Marxist, he wasn't fully confirmed Marxist, but he saw definitely correct trends in his thoughts in the 1920s, that in the First World War he refused to support the CGT leadership when they supported the war credits being put through in the French Parliament, and came out and formed the CGTU, the sort of the left-wing splinter group. But the point that Trotsky raises in it as a whole is that why it's so important that when asked, we look at it, is clarifying points, trying to raise points of him is that, as I said, trade union movement cannot revolutionarily change society. So what is it then? It is a reflection of working class, and particularly not even the most conscious elements of the working class. Working class people moving into struggle. When the vast majority of the working class who were put in the back foot and then have to move, do something about it. It's purely defensive then. A lot of trade union struggles we can see today, so they're not even defensive. They're definitely retreating. They're not even organising retreatments at all. Like, get back to where they're safe and maintain their membership and keep their membership dues coming in to maintain a bureaucracy. But that's this period and other periods as well. Generally, the trade union movement is always defensive. It's not a conscious policy of change in society. And then that raises another question. What role does a leadership of a trade union movement have? Like, organically, leadership can develop. Like, you know, this point, like, clarifies. You raise the point that leadership, people don't want to lead. People do not want somebody to come up and tell them what to do. But that's not all kinds of leadership. You know, the best, strongest leadership, but leadership is completely dependent on below. Then it's what the Social Party argues for, that all full-time officials should be elected. They should live on average the worker's wage, and they should be made accountable and be subject to recall. But that does not mean then that's the end of our demands, and suddenly we've got a left leadership and everything's fine. We campaign for them. We've done it in the classroom assistance strike. It was our members who put this forward, and that all the major decisions that were taken in the classroom assistance strike were by mass meetings of members getting together. They can decide what way to go forward. And in some cases, in some of the better ones, like in Branch 517, the South Eastern Education Ivy Board in Belfast, which is the most beloved areas, the other members of the union provided to come in and participate in the discussion, particularly in unison, because generally most of them left the union to go over to NIPS, so they joined. And they can see now the most militant aspect of the trade union movement because they've done this, that people not very directly point to John Corey as being the new trade union Arthur Scarborough or whatever, because he led a union that had a very good struggle. It's not the case whatsoever. The bureaucracy is, if anything, weakened by the struggles. The role of organisation, it was not that the Socialist Party is something that mass force, and this is not. It gave the chance for workers to have a say in how things were run in the union, which we've always campaigned for, and that led to the militancy. It wasn't us injecting militancy from the outside in. It was there all along, it was allowed to manifest itself. So just the question I'd like to have is the role of leadership in the trade union movement. And do you agree the treaty agreement is defensive? And if it is, then what conclusion can you draw from that? For me, if they need to build a revolutionary party, try and change society, that would be the other side of the coin. The treaty agreement is defensive, and the most conscious elements of the working class who see the need to immediately overthrow capitalism should come together in an organised grouping to try and do that.
Well, both Jason and Alan are something to say about that, but I, as a member of organised, my understanding is that as far as we're concerned, all human history up to this point has proven that to us that political parties are inevitably corrupt. And trade unions are not a revolutionary, we don't think they are. Revolutionary unions are. The masses themselves can be potentially, and that's what we look to, the masses themselves, not a leadership, but we ourselves. And we use the same sort of language as you're after using. People in delegates are elected and recallable. Yes. What does leadership mean? I mean, if I make a rousing speech, does that make me a leader? I mean, it depends what you mean by leadership. The point is, people who are in unaccountable positions constantly and are not recallable and are paid, that's a good question, are paid not only above the workers' wages, but paid at all in a position. They should continue to be workers, but go to delegate meetings as workers, and it should be... should they be paid at all? The CNP managed to be a revolutionary union, and they only had one official because they relied on the solidarity of the people. Yes,
Mario? Stuff ends with us, the union talks about wages and hours, and I think it would be interesting to talk about what kinds of things that we should be demanding. I mean, obviously wages, like people getting back their wages, better, improving their wages or abolishing their wage system is one thing. I would like to see a greater level of articulation from radical organizing about not just control of production so that we get to get the benefits of production, but control of production so that we get to change and choose what we produce. Like, buildings, how we, what type of architecture, how we organize our cities based on buildings, and that's labor that produces that. What type of, roads, what type of transportation system we have. And I think that would be a great place to expand activity in unions. There's stuff in Scandinavia that happened where unions pushed for arranging the structure of the workplace such that it wasn't set up in the same manner. So there's more control that was able to be enacted by workers because of the way that the structure was built. In fact,
a few comrades answer that as well as the other point about leadership and political parties and our unions revolutionaries.
Michael, talking about workers' control and people controlling their own industries and their own lives and where they work isn't. It's not separate from wanting to change society and the way we produce and the way we consume and, talking about alternatives that put more emphasis on public transport. There are all things that should be in the mix. We believe that should all be in the mix because organizers do not believe in the separation of economic organization and political organization. We don't believe that workers are limited by trade union consciousness. We do recognize severe problems with existing trade unions, but there are examples from all over the globe of revolutionary union movements, revolutionary syndicalist union movements and anarcho-syndicalist union movements that Jacques gave a talk on that earlier today. But the thing, the relationship between the rank and file, and yes, I would applaud any effort by workers to have assemblies and invite non-union members in, because, as I said earlier, people aren't always not in a union because they're scabs or potential scabs. Some workers have very real difficulties and have been let down in the past to the extent that they don't think that they should continue to belong to the likes of Unite. I'm sure quite a few people have thought about leaving for the whole airport workers was good. But again, it's not for us about putting in a new left-wing leadership. It is about the workers in the workplace. And I sort of think we need to bring this up. I mean, the point where Broad left and putting a new leadership in, the right-wing leadership of Bill Morris of the Transport and General Workers Union, Bill Morris was supported by what Militant and campaigned for in the Amalgamated Transport and General. No, no, originally Morris. Right back before he was elected, Militant supported his candidacy on the basis that he was left-wing. Then Woodley is supported on the basis that he's more left-wing than Morris and has ended up basically shafting workers all over again. So there's a more fundamental problem with the nature of trade unionism that I think is an issue there. You know, and I think that's highlighted in those campaigns. Would you like to comment on anything like that?
Well, just the question of unions and our revolutionary organisations. Well, clearly, looking around today, there's absolutely no question that the unions we are members of are defensive organisations. We might like them to go. That's what they are, and they're not even very good at the moment in terms of defending a lot of what we've gained in previous decades. Revolutionary, like, in society, it's not just a question of the capitalists over there, the work class are over there. It's all sorts of ideas around. Capitalists are well organised. They have plenty of mechanism for promoting their ideas. They control the daily papers. They control the TV stations. They control the editorial policy in the radio stations. Left and radical alternative views will get a mention here and there, but the dominant message is one of what we're living under at the moment. It's a normal, acceptable, proper way for things to be. Some revolutionaries were posing a different idea and trying to convince that our friends and neighbours and colleagues at work of these ideas. Obviously need to get organised to promote those ideas, to promote better strategies in struggle, to promote the very idea that it is quite not only legitimate, but it's a progressive thing for us to be engaged in struggle, that struggle is the way that things are improved, struggle is the way that we change the type of society we live in. I believe that the question of a revolutionary trade union movement, once we're talking of more than like a few hundred or a few thousand people, can only exist when there are thousands and thousands and thousands of revolutionaries in the working class. Unions, I said, by and large, much the same as any other large organisation, GAA, Irish Country Women's Association, whatever, by and large, they will represent where their members are at. Because if the members get really pissed off and feel they've been totally, having words put in their mouth and completely misrepresented, they're going to walk. So, you know, it's fairly obvious. So, revolutionary organisations are absolutely necessary. But it brings up the question of leadership. There's two essential types of leadership, I guess. There's the leadership of individuals. He's a really good guy. She's a really sound woman. Put her in there to do the job. We can trust her. We know her record. That's the leadership of the trustworthy personality. And historically, it's been an absolute failure. No matter how good people's intentions have been. The other sort of leadership is the leadership of ideas. But rather than trying to get support for a few individuals, you're trying to get support for a body of ideas. So it becomes, to a degree, almost irrelevant which individuals are on this committee or at that meeting, because it's the ideas that are dominant. And I think that's our key job in the unions, is to win a battle of ideas. A battle of ideas for opposition social partnership, far more struggle, far decisions being taken by the people who are going to be affected by them. Sometimes on the left, we let ourselves down very, very badly. And I just want to give one example. At a CIVDU conference a few years ago, a delegate got up and made a very impassioned speech about how at the previous conference 2 years past, we passed a motion that the union should organise, should protest to the government about health cuts. And this guy wondered, where were the marches? Where were the strikes? Why is the union just ignored it?
Of course, the reality was all the most said was organised a protest. So of course, the Conservative majority on the NEC said, right, the way we fulfil our obligations there, we'd send a letter to the Minister for Health saying, hey, these cuts are a really bad idea, we wish you wouldn't go ahead with them. Now they fulfilled them and they give them by Congress, because the left sometimes gets caught up in just sort of easy slogan instead of trying to tie the fuckers down. A far better vote would have been that, you know, within the next 12 months or 18 months, the National Executive must organise a national demonstration, must organise a one-day stoppage, you know, whatever you think is possible. You need to tie them down an awful lot more, rather than looking for the good individual who will do things for us. And I just want to speak just on how union struggles can move beyond just even a sort of a militant defence of our position at the moment, or a slight extension of it. How they can people involved can change quite significantly. You're talking about sort of, you know, issues like transport and so on. Back in the 70s, there was a union on the sites in Australia, the Builders Labourers Federation. Quite a multitude, and it was the majority union of building workers in Australia at the time. In a period of a lot of struggle around wages and so on, they also took up a tactic known as green bands, long before the word green, like it become associated with Patricia McKenna, so your man, the councillor from the Gold Coast. What they did there was, where there was a big development in an area, and local people were opposed to that development for some reason, or like say a park was going to be turned into a shopping centre, if the majority of people in the area were opposed to it, the union had a policy that none of our members work on that. If people have been evicted by a landlord because he wants to gentrify, their policy was none of our members work on that job and we will put pickets on it. And that carried on for several years. Now unfortunately it came to an end because they were isolated within the trade union movement. So when the government moved on them, other unions stood aside in the hope of, as the BLF was smashed, taking in their membership. And in fact that is what happened. But that happened in the context of almost like these things sort of happening in the momentum of struggle and very few people sitting down and saying, what's happening? Now if we learn lessons from stuff like that, because opportunities like that will arise again, maybe the next time we can be far better prepared, that it'll be more than a flash in the pan showing what's possible, and instead it'll be the beginning of, you know, a progression of struggle.
I think a big problem is the arise within the workers. A society where they can legitimately protest. I think you've adequately forgotten lessons taught in the past. If we can bring your memory back, there was a certain individual in America who was arrested for speaking seditious speeches. And he said, oh, Salvation Army are doing it. The difference between the Salvation Army and them was Salvation Army were singing their protest marks, protest those. Same time as they don't get the same hours. That was Joe Hill, a people like second one Tanzani.
Sure.
I mean, they had meetings with just quits on saying that too long to wait to remember. I've yet to hear a song called Solidarity, or any other song, Union Miners, or any Woody Guthrie song, or Peggy Seegers.
Anybody got no home in this world anymore.
You can laugh at it, and I think you need these BB songs to inculcate into the hearts of the working class a wee bit of hope, a wee bit of sincerity, and more or less more membership in the heavy system.
Well, Alan did read some lines of Joe Hill's earlier. He didn't quite sing
the words. Okay, we're an anarchist, wasn't it?
Yeah, with the voices for singing it to me.
Is it Chrissy Murugali anyway? Should we sing a
good singer? Well, no, I can't sing, and I'd have to put on another 18 stone.
No, but you're very young. You're very young. Like,
oh, yeah, you're very young.
Hey, can I just say, on behalf of the working class, a lot of lefties complain that we're, you know, this trade union consciousness and all this, and we should be more militant and on the defensive one. As I understand the Thatcherite laws at the moment, if the unions go on strike, if they don't ballot their members using the government machinery, the government legally can sequester their take the money of the union. Just take it off them. End of story.
Secret trade of funds.
Exactly. So that's why the trade union, not just the leadership, the trade union movement as a whole is very cautious. As I understand the rule of thumb is, if you want, if you want to do things illegally, you have to be a lightning strike. You have to organize your workplace in quite very quickly. That's the only way it's going to be effective. If not, then you have to do things legally, and it takes forever, and by that time, maybe the boss is ready for the action. So, it's not easy, God knows, and that's why it needs these industrial networks. It needs people who are interested in revolutionary unions to get in contact with each other and to form like industrial networks. And I also wanted to say that Jason was talking about mass meetings. So the word mass meetings is used a lot on the left. There's also a possibility of even in small groups of workers choosing people. You don't have to elect them. You can rotate posts. You can take turns. And to go to meetings, just meetings of delegates from a very small base, it doesn't have to be necessarily mass meetings. That's all I want. Michael?
Just on the issue of electing delegates, I mean, certainly people would have a pretty strong critique of the trade union mimicking the electoral democracy. Trade unions use parliamentary procedure, it's called parliamentary procedure, because it was, you know, invented by the parliament, which was originally kind of the you know, nobility and aristocracy. I mean, we sort of know that history of government. And it's a process that is designed to take people's power away. And then trade unions, of course, use that affiliated thing. So, you know, in terms of sort of the elected and recallable delegates, I mean, one is there's all this good strategy bit about using that because it is, and I'm advocating that, because it is very similar to what is people are standardly taught in the trade union movements about decision making in meetings. They relate to it. So it's sort of culturally akin. But I wonder if people, you know, can talk about when the sort of delegating process becomes, you know, what kind of critique one can put into that delegating process. Where is it sort of useful? I mean, I hear the phrase elected and kind of recallable and accountable. I mean, why do we need to, you know, why do we need to do delegates in some sense? I don't know how my hair wants to.
I
think this is an interesting discussion. I think there's obviously differences between the anarchist movement and the Marxist movement, so there is, on this the issue. But just to raise maybe a few points, like you raised the question of the leadership, the idea that physical leadership doesn't make a difference. It's a theory of ideas, which I think the importance of ideas being injected is key, and that's what I would say creates the new leadership. But for example, in Britain today, you have left-leaning unions, and I think a point you made, like people like Mark Zabaka, Bob Crowe, Matt Rath, but they do reflect that they're a threat to the system. There's a real fear of them, especially in London. But they do scare capitalist class, and they are a powerful force. They do mobilise the workers in defence of their interests. And just the second point on you said earlier, your opposition to the political organisation of the working class. The way I would see it, the workers, the trade unions should be next to political organisations. I'm completely in favour of that. I think I'm opposed to the connection of the Labour Party, obviously, but workers do need that connection. People like that can advance the ideas of the working class in any other form. And just finally, one point on the idea of revolutionary unions. I don't really agree that there's such a thing that you can't have revolutionary unions as such, because I think what it is unions at a certain point, for example the mass unions and the industrial workers are just products of that time. They're the products of a certain period of black struggle, and they're just going to disperse eventually. Every example of what's called a revolutionary union doesn't need to last on and it's full of cases.
Right. Before I let the comments go back on that,
hello, are you there?
Hang on, Gary, you have
to be
just a point to make there. The Fora, for example, was started out in 1901 as Fora, but previously it was the FOA. That organization they were organizing for 75 years before they were crushed by military dictatorship because the boss class was so afraid of that organization, which at the time had 650,000 members. Likewise, the CNT had one paid official, which was basically the general secretary. And the idea to suggest that because it has political momentum, that it actually has a final aim, which is to create a free and fascist society, to somehow denounce that is actual political capacity, a capacity to make decisions, is just beyond me. I can't understand where you come from for that. Just another point that trust even existed. I mean, trust even admitted that as far as the party is concerned, the party is always behind the class in struggle. Always behind the class in struggle. The benefits of revolutionary unionism when it does actually not separate mental labor and manual labor, when it doesn't separate the capacity to decide, but the capacity, the brawn of the working class, is when it doesn't separate that into a party which is making the decisions and the workers which are the class basis, when it creates an integral organization, which for me is out of a syndicalism, that is at the same time leading the struggle. In the Spanish Revolution, the CNT, although it made its mistakes, was definitely a revolutionary organization. And just one last point to write. Concerning Monarchs and CGT in France, the CGT in France rejected control of political, any single political party controlling it. It also made a point depreciating politics within the CGT, and that was one of its failures. I don't consider that to be anarcho-syndicalism. I consider that to be an apolitical, to its extreme apolitical. And it wasn't able to cope with anti-militarism in an organized sense because you couldn't discuss anti-militarism and organize against it. So within the CGT. So there is a flaw in not allowing political capacity in the class. And if you look carefully at the history of the CGT, I'm sure you recognize that. When us were considered itself revolutionary syndicalist and objected to being considered an anarchist syndicalist precisely for that reason. Anarchist syndicalists insist that the political decision making capacity and the economic brawn of the class is in the union.
I'm not going to say anything about that.
Yeah. Can I have a say here? I have Hillary for picking up my hand, and I haven't picked up my hand. I just want to say a lot of things. First of all, as the Marxists would say, the emancipation of the worker. The emancipation is of the working class. I think, was it Engels said that? The emancipation must be, you know, how can you believe in the emancipation of the working class if you're leaving it via party and party discipline and all those nonsense? I'm not saying, you know, this is what I'm trying to get across here. The organization of the working class must be the sole prerogative of the working class. Now, if you're saying that there, I think it came from them. I don't know, you can tell me more about that dictatorship than I can. But the dictatorship, you know, surely...
Sorry, I think I missed a point. We're short on time.
What?
We're short on time here. Would you like to come back on anything before we wrap up?
Well, just a couple of things. Why have delegates? Well, anything that gets beyond a small friendship circle, you don't need them. Like, you know, I'm in a union at the moment that's claiming 210,000 members. We're not all, even if everybody wants to go to a meeting, you wouldn't even fit them all into Croke Park, and you'd be waiting several years to get your chance to say anything. I think the key question is whether you have delegates or representatives, and the two are very different. A delegate is somebody you give a specific job to. and say, right, we want you to go and do that. A representative is somebody, we say, well, we sort of like you, we trust your general judgment, you go and decide what's good for us. That's the essential difference. What we need is more delegation and less representation. The members giving instructions to their delegates rather than receiving instruction from their representative. As to the unions being affiliated to political parties, well, the hard reality is, like, let's leave aside for the moment the question of how we think society can be changed. In unions that are affiliated to the Labour Party, including my own, when you build up a head of steam on what's seen as a political issue, something that isn't directly bread and butter, the first response of the bureaucracy is always, we can't be dealing with this, we're affiliated to the Labour Party, they look after that stuff. So that's the very first hurdle you have to deal with, that your so-called allies are there to stop you even discussing the issue. The reality, regardless of the intentions, tends to be that unions are just really for industrial matters, and the broader political issues are to be taken to another forum, which the unions may have a say in, they may send some delegates down to a committee, but essentially it's not to be an important part of the business of the members, and I think that is the biggest problem with it. Whether that be the Labour Party, an anarchist organisation, or anything else, organisations should be there competing on the basis of their ideas, trying to get support on the basis of, do our ideas make more sense than anybody else? Are they more useful to you? Rather than signing our union up because you managed to get a majority at conference or on the bridge. So I think you have to have an individual membership ballot, which maybe 10 or 12% of the members take part in. It hasn't been helpful, even when you will be on the Labour Party. Like, for a brief period, the RMT, the Rail and Siemens Union, was affiliated a couple of years ago to the Scottish Socialist Party. I don't think it really made any difference, any particular assistance to railway workers in Scotland in terms of their struggles.
Before I say a few things in closing, I'd just like to thank everybody for coming along. I'd like to thank Paddy for his update on Gordon McNeill's case and the dispute with Unite. I'd like to thank Alan for coming on from Dublin.
Actually, it's great to go somewhere where it hasn't been raining solidly for 3 weeks.
You weren't here. I do think it's important, you know, people talk about leadership. Really, I thought it was interesting that when you mentioned left-leaning unions in Britain, you mentioned the leaders, and forgot one of their names, of those unions. I would say, you know, the Fire Brigade Union, firefighters, are pretty much in the vanguard of the working class at the minute. I would mention more that during the firefighters' dispute, Northern Ireland had the biggest return in favour of going for industrial action. I think it was 97%. I think the leadership that's shown there is shown by the firefighters themselves, not the person who's elected as secretary or whatever.
That was first, and then it created the new leadership.
Again, organised don't believe that politics and economic organisation should be separated. We do have enough faith in working class people to see the potential for them to be able to not just exercise industrial muscle, but to make the decisions about the direction that a labour movement that should be controlled by the workers that make up that labour movement should go in. But again, yes, I would just like to thank everybody for coming along and thank everyone for contributing to the discussion. And I'd like to thank the unemployed Centre for letting us use the place.